coming up on Star Stuff. A Trojan asteroid discovered in Earth's orbit. Evidence for volcanoes found on the far side of the moon. And all systems go for this week's launch of NASA's next mission to Jupiter. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
Astronomers have found the first Trojan asteroid sharing Earth's orbit around the Sun. Trojans are asteroids in specific orbital positions called Lagrangian points of stability, roughly 60 degrees ahead and behind of a planet in its orbit around the Sun. At these positions, the gravitational forces of a planet and the Sun balance each other out, locking an asteroid in place. Trojans have previously been discovered accompanying Neptune, Jupiter, and Mars. Scientists, including Dr. Martin Connors from Athabasca University in Canada, suspect there may have been Trojans in stable positions orbiting with the Earth as well. But Connors says finding Earth Trojans is difficult because their location can only be seen from Earth in daylight. The launch of NASA's Wide-Field Infrared Survey Explorer spacecraft, WISE, in 2009 made the job of hunting for Trojans a lot easier. WISE, which looks in the infrared, is especially good at detecting asteroids. So far, it's found something like 150,000 of them, 500 of the type which come near the Earth. By examining the orbit of these objects in the WISE data, Connors and colleagues identified one specific asteroid, 2010 TK7, which they figured could be a possible Earth Trojan. They then used ground-based telescopes to confirm the sighting, calculating that it's actually been in a stable orbit with Earth for more than 10,000 years. Reporting in the journal Nature, Connors says 2010 TK7 was detected because it's on an eccentric orbit, which causes it to slow down and speed up.
Well, a Trojan, due to a special relationship between the planet's gravity and the Sun's gravity, can hang around on the planet's orbit as long as it's fairly close to 60 degrees ahead of or behind the planet. So there are several thousand of these known for Jupiter. Of course, Jupiter is the heavyweight of the solar system, and it has a lot of gravitational pull. The interesting thing is that we have now actually found one for the Earth, too.
And what do we know about this Trojan that you've discovered that appears to be orbiting, what is it, about 60 degrees in front of the Earth?
Well, on average, it's that distance, but it does wander back and forth quite a bit. And in answer to your question, what do we know about it, apart from the fact that it's a Trojan, we know pretty well nothing about it,
okay,
which hopefully will change in the near future.
Got a rough estimate for its size, I believe, based on what you've been able to detect?
Yes, that's just based on how bright it is, and then you assume how much light it actually reflects. And so based on that, you get a pretty rough idea of the size.
And the albedo gives you an idea of the size. What size do you think it is, roughly?
Well, it would be a few hundred meters in diameter. So sort of like the size of a small neighborhood or something like that. When you're looking out towards Jupiter, then you've got no real problem picking up its Trojans because they're in the night sky for us a lot of the time. But for our own Trojans, they're kind of near to the Sun. I mean, they're not right on top of the Sun or anything, but they're the sort of thing you'll see for an hour or so in the evening, an hour or so in the morning, and that's your only opportunity to go and look for them. And due to that short time that is available to even do the searching, just none have been found to date.
And when you did the searching and you selected a couple of targets which looked likely, how did you narrow it down to this one example?
Well, the first one that we thought looked likely turned out to be another type of asteroid called a horseshoe object. Now, they're quite interesting too, but they were already known, so you don't really get a new discovery if you follow up a horseshoe object. In fact, we were involved with discoveries of those a number of years ago. But the second one, when we calculated out the orbit, it had a different behavior, and it turned out to be a Trojan. Now, at the time, we weren't sure, so we had to nail it down by getting some observations at the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope.
It seemed to match your predictions to where it should be if it was a Trojan. What are some of the characteristics you were able to find out about its orbit?
Well, it's a typical orbit that makes it be classified as a Trojan, but it's fairly extreme in its behaviors. And that's partly what allowed it to be discovered, because it was discovered fairly far away from the Sun in the sky. And that's due to its fairly eccentric orbit, which causes it to slow down and speed up so that it looks like it varies its apparent separation from the Sun a fair bit.
Now, I believe you refer to this as a tadpole orbit.
Yes, the overall orbit is called a tadpole orbit, and it does that orbit over 400 years. But every year, it also moves back and forth in the sky quite a bit. And that's what allowed it to be snagged by the satellite.
We now know there's one there. I think there are, what, three around Neptune, two around Mars. So Jupiter, as you pointed out, has, what, something like 1,800 of them. So it got the largest amount by far. How long's a piece of string, I guess. But is it likely there are more Trojans out there that are yet to be discovered?
Well, I think so. I've been looking for these for a number of years, and that's based on the belief that they would exist. Well, they do exist. We've got one. The question is, are the ones that hang around closer to the Lagrange points going to be found? Do they really exist? And I would think that finding one like this would enhance our chances of just getting the telescope time to go and look.
The United States at the moment is looking for a deep space mission, to send astronauts to an asteroid. Is this the sort of target you'd like to see the Americans look at, or would something like that be too small at 300 meters across?
Well, 300 meters is going to be a decent size, so I think an object of that size could be a decent target. The problem with this particular one is it's on quite a tilted orbit, and it takes quite a bit of energy to get into a tilted orbit. So as a result, this particular one would not be very good. So we have to come back again to the idea that this one existing could stimulate searches for others.
That's Dr. Martin Connors from Athabasca University in Canada. Scientists have found evidence of volcanoes on the far side of the moon. The new discovery, reported in the journal Nature Geoscience, is a rare example of volcanism on the lunar surface not associated with asteroid, meteor, or comet impact events. Until now, the best-known examples of volcanism were all on the moon's near side, in a region known as the Procellarium creep terrain. Scientists used images and other data gathered from NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter to assess the composition of an unusual region on the far side of the moon, called the Compton-Belkovich Thorium Anomaly. They focused on an area containing numerous domes, some over 6 kilometres wide. The domes featured steeply sloping sides, which scientists are interpreting as volcanic in origin and formed from viscous lava. They also detected circular depressions suggesting caldera collapse or volcanic vents. The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter data indicates the rocks could be rich in thorium, silica, and alkali feldspar minerals. That means the lavas would be compositionally evolved, making them different from the black basalts that make up the abundant lunar maria observed elsewhere on the moon. The data also suggests that the Compton-Belkovich thorium anomaly may be as little as 800 million years old. Now, in geologic terms, that makes it the youngest identified volcanic feature on the moon. In the process, it extends the period of active lunar volcanism by at least 200 million years. Scientists have developed one of the most accurate measurements ever made of how fast the universe is expanding. The research, reported in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, will help cosmologists better understand how the universe is evolving and how it's likely to change over time. Physicists, including Florian Butler from the International Centre for Radio Astronomy Research at the University of Western Australia, calculated the cosmic expansion by measuring the Hubble constant with greater accuracy. The Hubble constant's a key number in astronomy because it's used to calculate the size and age of the universe. However, the universe is always expanding, with galaxies and galaxy clusters all moving away from each other as part of that expansion. And to complicate matters, there's the mysterious little understood force of dark energy, which is actually accelerating that rate of expansion. All this means the Hubble constant can really only tell scientists what's happening right now, a bit like a snapshot in time. Butler and colleagues believe current measurements on the cosmic scale are based on well-established assumptions but are prone to systematic errors. You see, distances are worked out using so-called standard candles. Now, these include stars called Cepheid variables, which are known to brighten and fade at set rates and by set degrees of luminosity. The other standard candles are type 1a supernovae, stars which explode at the end of their lives when they reach a certain mass and always give off a certain level of brightness. In both cases, scientists know how bright the object is. So when you compare their known brightness with how bright they appear, scientists can work out how far away they must be. In other words, the fainter they are, the further away they are. Butler says there are too many variables with this method, so he decided to tackle the problem using a different method.
What we're trying to do is we're trying to figure out properties of the universe, like how fast it is expanding, how old it is, how it will end, how it started, and these kind of things.
And the way that's been done up to now is usually with things like the Hubble constant, and I take it that's what you're looking at, but you're looking at it in a more precise fashion.
So the Hubble constant gives you the expansion of the universe right now. And that's a very important parameter because many other parameters like the matter density in the universe and the age of the universe are degenerated with this parameter, and therefore we need to know that parameter very, very well. And in the past, it has been determined with the so-called distance letter technique, which means that you build up a distance letter by making distance measurements in the local universe, and you try to get out with calibrating other distance measurements.
So that's when you look for, say, Cepheid variables in nearby, and then you look for type 1a supernovas further away.
Exactly, yeah, that's it. And the problem with that technique is that for supernovae, for example, you don't know the physics behind the supernova exactly. So there could be an uncertainty which is not accounted for, and the same with Cepheid variables and with masers, which they use in this technique. And the new technique is just very, very robust, because what you do is you count galaxies at certain distance scales, and there's actually nothing which can go wrong. So it's a very robust method.
Now, I take it this involves baryonic acoustic oscillations.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so here we've got galaxies, they tend to be certain distances apart, galaxy pairs.
So we have a galaxy catalogue with 120,000 galaxies, and what we do is we measure the distance between galaxy pairs. So we pair up all the galaxies in the catalogue, and then we measure the distances. And it happens that the separation between galaxies has a peak or has a preferred scale, and this preferred scale gives you a distance measurement. So we just need to detect this preferred scale. It's very difficult because it's a very small signal. But if you have a big galaxy catalog, then you can detect that. And the reason why that is because in the very early universe, about 300,000 years after the Big Bang, there were some sound waves going through the plasma which we had at that point, and these sound waves are burned into the distribution of matter today, and we can detect the size of these sound waves, and the size of these sound waves is always one scale, which is around 150 megaparsecs.
As those sound waves, as those pressure waves expand out, that distance between each pressure wave, between the peaks and the troughs in these waves, that would change, wouldn't it, as space-time itself changes?
Well, it changes from... So the universe starts about 1 second after inflation, these sound waves start, and then they move for 300,000 years, and then they stop, because at 300,000 years after the Big Bang, the universe transits from a radiation-dominated universe to a matter-dominated universe. In a matter-dominated universe, these sound waves cannot travel anymore, because the reason why they traveled was the so-called radiation pressure, and this radiation pressure doesn't exist anymore in a matter-dominated universe.
Okay, so they're frozen in time at 300. Exactly. This is what the same age of the cosmic microwave background. Is that what you're using as the scale?
That's exactly, yeah. So we use the CMB to calibrate our measurements. So we have to combine our measurement with the CMB. So this is exactly the same physics. And we know this physics is very well understood because of the CMB physics with WMAP and with COBE.
And so by looking at that, we know roughly how far apart these pressure waves are, so how far apart galaxy pairs are.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's Florian Butler from the International Centre for Radio Astronomy Research at the University of Western Australia. American scientists expect to establish within months whether or not the Higgs boson, the so-called God particle, actually exists or not. Physicists at the US Department of Energy's Fermilab are reporting that they're narrowing down the mass range where the Higgs boson is likely to be hiding. The Higgs is the last missing piece of the so-called standard model of particle physics. It's the particle that gives mass to all the other particles through something called a Higgs field. Fermilab's Tevatron particle accelerator near Chicago and the Large Hadron Collider operated by CERN, the European Organisation for Nuclear Research, are engaged in a frantic neck-and-neck struggle to try and find the missing particle. Both groups are smashing subatomic particles together at 99.9% of light speed, creating collisions that briefly hit temperatures 100,000 times hotter than the Sun. Scientists then sift through this fleeting subatomic rubble for clues to a host of unsolved mysteries about the origins and makeup of the universe, including the search for the Higgs. Antimatter research and the creation of quark-gluon plasma, the hottest and densest substance since the Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago, have both been byproducts of this massive multi-billion dollar effort. CERN researchers had earlier reported that the Higgs had so far evaded detection with the Large Hadron Collider, and they believed it could be next year before the Higgs is found. As part of their effort, CERN scientists have increased the amount of collisions they're undertaking by a factor of 20 over the past year. Large Hadron Collider physicists say they now know just about everything about the Higgs, except for whether it actually exists or not. Meanwhile, researchers at Fermilab have now also reported telltale signs of the elusive particle. Both sides have reduced the range of mass within which the Higgs might be found to a fairly narrow low-mass band. So the search for the Higgs is now entering its most exciting and definitely final stages. But the US team is on a far tighter schedule. Fermilab says its researchers on the center's Tevatron Collider are now extremely close to the sensitivity needed either to see a substantial excess of Higgs-like events or to be able to rule out the existence of the particle altogether. Earlier research at the Tevatron, in operation since 1983, and at the much bigger Large Hadron Collider, which has been operational since 2010, have now left only a narrow window for the Higgs, first postulated by British scientist Peter Higgs some 40 years ago. And Fermilab scientists say their experiments with the Tevatron are on track to collect enough data by the end of September to close that window. You see, the September deadline's important for the physicists at Fermilab. That's because that's the date when the Tevatron is due to shut down for good. Over the past few months, there have been growing reports from both Fermilab and CERN that scientists were closing in on the Higgs. For example, both groups are reporting unusual fluctuations, tantalizing bumps in their data. Still, others are cautioning that these could simply be misreadings or random anomalies. Only time will tell. We'll keep you informed. All systems are go for this week's launch of NASA's next mission to the giant gas planet Jupiter. The Juno spacecraft is slated to fly on an Atlas V rocket from Launch Complex 41 at the Cape Canaveral Air Force Base in Florida on August the 5th. Once it finally reaches the Jovian system in July 2016, Juno will spend a year orbiting inside Jupiter's deadly radiation belts, far closer than any previous orbiting spacecraft. At this distance, it'll learn how much water the giant planet holds, what triggers its vast magnetic fields, and whether or not a solid core lies beneath that dense, hot atmosphere. Scientists believe Jupiter was the first planet to form after the birth of the solar system. But exactly how that happened is still unknown. One key piece of missing data is how much water is inside the gas giant, which orbits the Sun 5 times further away than Earth. Like the Sun, Jupiter is comprised mostly of hydrogen and helium, with a sprinkling of other elements like oxygen. Scientists believe the oxygen is bound up with the hydrogen in the form of water, and that can be measured with microwave sounders, one of 8 science instruments aboard Juno, a giant spacecraft about the size of a bus. Jupiter's water content is directly tied to how and where the planet formed. And that's important because there's some evidence which is pointing to Jupiter having grown in a much colder outer region of the solar system and then migrated inwards to where it is now. But then again, there are other computer models which show that Jupiter could well have formed exactly where it is now simply by accumulating lots of icy snowballs. Jupiter is often called the king of planets, having over twice the mass of all the other planets in the solar system combined. Being so huge, it has the gravitational muscle to hang on to nearly all its original building materials, and that's why scientists want to go back there. Jupiter is a window on how planets formed in the protoplanetary molecular gas and dust of the primordial solar system. Instead of studying the Jovian moons as NASA's Galileo spacecraft did a decade ago, Juno will thread itself into a narrow region between the planet and the inner edge of its radiation belt. The Lockheed Martin-built solar-powered probe will spend a year orbiting over Jupiter's poles, coming as close as 5,000 kilometers above the cloud tops. Only one atmospheric probe released by Galileo flew closer to that, relaying data for 58 minutes before finally succumbing to the planet's crushing pressure and intense heat. Although Juno's electronics are protected by titanium, they too will eventually fail in the harsh Jovian radiation environment after about a year. So like Galileo before it, Juno's last move will be a suicide death plunge into the planet's atmosphere. In order to avoid any possible chance of contaminating Jupiter's potentially life-bearing moons. Space exploration technology SpaceX have been given approval to dock their Dragon capsule to the International Space Station, making them the first private company to do so. SpaceX will combine the planned second and third test flights for its Dragon into a single mission, which will fly on SpaceX's own Falcon 9 rocket on November 30th. The reusable Dragon capsule successfully carried out its first orbital flight in December 2010, blasting off from Launch Complex 40 at the Cape Canaveral Air Force Base in Florida. After 3 hours of orbital maneuvering, testing spacecraft systems at altitudes of 300 kilometers, Dragon re-entered the atmosphere and successfully splashed down in the Pacific Ocean. Although it'll be initially used to transport cargo to and from the space station, SpaceX have made no secret of their desire to eventually use the Dragon to ferry crews to the ISS. In cargo mode, Dragon will carry up to 6 tons of supplies to the space station and be capable of carrying 3 tons of return payloads back to Earth. In human spaceflight configuration, Dragon will transport 7 astronauts to and from the space station. As well as Pad 40 at Cape Canaveral in Florida, SpaceX have also leased Launch Complex 4 at the Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. That should be ready for Falcon 9 launches late next year. A third launch facility is also planned for an atoll in the Marshall Islands in the Pacific Ocean. Well, it's still got a science module to be added before construction is complete, but the Russian space agency Roscosmos are already talking about the ultimate destruction of the International Space Station. Moscow says the $100 billion facility will be deorbited to allow it to burn up in the atmosphere during re-entry over the Pacific Ocean at the end of its life cycle after 2020. That's just 9 years away. Roscosmos says after it completes its existence, they'll be forced to sink the ISS because it's too complex and too big to be left in orbit. The first segment of the ISS was launched back in 1998. Apparently, the original plan was to keep it flying for just 15 years. A subsequent agreement was reached to keep it orbiting until at least 2020. The plan to deorbit is designed to ensure the ISS doesn't end up as a piece of space junk. By diving into a watery grave, the ISS will repeat the fate of its predecessor, the Russian Mir space station, which Moscow guided into the Pacific Ocean in 2001 after 15 years of service. Meanwhile, Moscow's confirmed it's commenced working on an eventual replacement for the Soyuz capsule. The new spaceship, which will begin flight tests in 2015, will be partially reusable. At the moment, the Soyuz replacement is known only by its code name, the PPTS, or Prospective Piloted Transport System. Like the US Orion, it'll be designed for both low Earth orbit, that is, taking crews to the space station, and also undertaking longer duration flights to the moon. The 12-ton Earth-orbiting version of the new capsule will carry a crew of 6 as well as half a ton of supplies. The unmanned cargo version of the vehicle will be required to carry no less than 2 tons into low Earth orbit and at least half a ton back to the planet's surface. In lunar configuration, the spacecraft would have a mass of 16.5 tons and carry 4 people as well as 100 kilograms of cargo and supplies. Roscosmos say the new capsule will be capable of flying up to 10 missions with a 15-year lifespan. A Delta IV rocket has successfully blasted into orbit, carrying the newest satellite in the American GPS network. Known as the GPS-2F2 satellite, it will replace the GPS-2A11, which has been operating for 20 years. The Delta IV liftoff from Launch Complex 37 at the Cape Canaveral Air Force Base in Florida marked the 50th successful flight for the Global Positioning Satellite Network system. It's third time lucky for a Russian Soyuz rocket, successfully carrying 6 American Globestar telecommunications satellites into orbit. The Soyuz Frigate rocket lifted off from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in the Central Asian Republic of Kazakhstan. The flight, which was carried out on behalf of Ariane Space, had been postponed twice earlier in the week because of technical glitches. Meanwhile, China's busy launch schedule's continuing with another flight from the Xichang Satellite Launch Center from southwestern Sichuan Province. The latest flight involved a Long March 3A rocket carrying Beijing's 9th Beidou or Compass Navigation Satellite. It'll form part of a 35-bird constellation designed to guide China's rapidly expanding military assets. Last week, China launched its second telecommunications data satellite, the Tianlian 102. The first, Tianlian 101, was launched back in April 2008. The two spacecraft will form an orbital network for China's growing space program, providing data relay and measurements and control services for China's spacecraft and planned space stations. And time now on Star Stuff for a look at the rest of the week's science and technology news with a science report. A new campaign to encourage African men to get circumcised to prevent infection by HIV has gained a powerful boost with 3 new studies unveiled at the World AIDS Forum in Rome. Scientists have confirmed that new cases of HIV among men fell by an astonishing 76% after a circumcision campaign was launched in a region of South Africa. The new findings follow earlier trials in 2006 in Kenya, Uganda and South Africa, which found foreskin removal almost halved a man's risk of infection by HIV, the human immunodeficiency virus, which causes AIDS. The new study was conducted between 2007 and 2010 in Orange Farm. That's a township of 1,100 adults, where more than 20,000 circumcisions have been performed, especially among boys and men aged 15 to 24, the group which is most sexually active. Interestingly, as a side study, 87.7% of men said they found it easy to reach orgasm after being circumcised, and 92.3% said they experienced more sexual pleasure during their sexual encounters. The theory behind the benefits of circumcision is that the inner foreskin's an easy entry point for HIV. It's rich in so-called Langerhans cells, tissues that the AIDS virus can easily latch onto and penetrate. New research has concluded that children and adolescents using cell phones are at no greater risk of developing brain cancers than non-cell phone users. The research in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute looked at whether children could be more vulnerable to the health risks of electromagnetic radiation through mobile phone use because their central nervous systems are still developing and also because they have smaller head circumferences, thereby allowing radiation to penetrate deeper into the brain. The study by the Swiss Tropical and Public Health Institute in Basel examined kids aged 7 to 19. 352 of those subjects were brain cancer patients, while a further 646 were control subjects. Scientists found the tumour patients were no more likely to be regular cell phone users than the control subjects, none of whom had cancer. Researchers in Melbourne think they may have found a way to treat some of the most aggressive forms of breast cancer. Women diagnosed with basal-like breast cancer have traditionally relied on chemotherapy. However, sadly, survival rates are still low. Now researchers have trialled treating basal cancer using chemotherapy combined with a new class of drugs. Dr. Jeff Lindemann from the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute says his team have had good results so far. Well, it looks like Archaeopteryx, long venerated as the dinosaur ancestor of birds, may well have been knocked off its perch by a newly discovered species from China. A report in the journal Nature claims a previously unknown dinosaur fossil called Zhao Tinja, which has been found in Liaoning province in China's northeast, shares many of the key characteristics of Archaeopteryx. Since its discovery 150 years ago in Bavaria, most paleontologists have placed Archaeopteryx squarely at the root of a broad group of proto-birds known as Aviale, from which all modern-day birds eventually evolved. The new discovery doesn't change the view that birds are descended from theropod dinosaurs, but it does mean that the iconic Archaeopteryx may well be nothing more than just another dinosaur with feathers. Archaeologists have uncovered a tiny 2,000-year-old golden bell amongst ruins in the Old City region of Jerusalem. Israel's Antiquities Authority says the bell was uncovered during excavation work on a drainage channel in the City of David, an area in an Arab neighborhood just south of the Old City walls. The bell was found inside the main drainage channel, taking water from different parts of the city to the Pool of Siloam, a location mentioned in the Bible. The bells were apparently sewn onto robes worn by Jewish high priests ministering in the Second Temple. And for more news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science. If you missed it on the radio, don't forget Star Stuff is available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. The Star Stuff blog is always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, and heaps of other media we couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences, and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates, and cool URLs. Just Google in the @ symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word and in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And that's the show for now. A special thanks to ABC Radio National and the ABC Science Unit for all their help and facilities. I'm Stuart Gary, and we'll be back next week with more Star Stuff.